We do have all lines connected. Recording lines are connected. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO-PDP Working Group call on Wednesday, 17th of April, 2013. On the call today we have Jim Bykoff, Elizabeth Finberg, Chuck Gomes, Stefan Hankins, Volkan Claymosher, David Hisley, Kieran Marin-Jarryville, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickert, Greg Shatton, Claude Yamak-Master-Tamarit, David Roach-Turner, and Mary Wong, as well as Mason Cole. We have apologies from Osvaldo Novoa, David Maher, Ricardo Gillum, Alan Greenberg, and Guylaine Fournet. And from staff, we have Barry Kopp, Brian Peck, and myself, Julia Charvelin. May I remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much. And before we move to the second agenda item, I'd like to ask whether there are any updates to statements of interest. Hearing and reading none. Before we move to the next agenda item, let me just clarify. I guess there has been some confusion surrounding the starting time because since due to changes to summertime, you know, the starting time also changed for at least for some of us. And David, you have asked by email whether we could rotate in a different way than we do now, i.e. by starting earlier. I am not sure whether this is possible due to ICANN policy staff meetings on Wednesdays and the registry stakeholder group call. I'm not sure whether ICANN staff is in a position to say something about that now, but we can definitely look into that. But if I remember correctly, these were the two other activities on Wednesdays that prevented us from starting earlier than we do every other week. Barry, Brian, do you have any more information on that, or is there scope to start earlier?
I think, Thomas, this is Brian Peck. Given that both Europe and U.S. are on daylight savings time, an hour earlier would not necessarily conflict with the weekly policy, you know, regularly scheduled policy staff call. However, I'm not sure about any, you know, continuing conflicts with the registry group.
Okay, so we'll make sure that we reach out to the registries and check with them. And should we have this additional hour that we can start earlier, I think we should use that opportunity every second week. Now,
Thomas,
who's that?
Sorry to interrupt. I
Chuck.
Mute. Yes. The registry call will, let's see, it's 10 o'clock, so it's 1 o'clock. That should not enter. 10 o'clock should on... should not, let's see, I better get the right time zone. I don't think there's any conflict. The registry call goes from 10 to noon Eastern time. So I think we're still okay.
That's good news. So can I ask ICANN staff to look into this and, if possible, adjust the starting time accordingly? That would be great. So we can now move to the second agenda item, which is the discussion of the GAC communique on IGO names and the ICANN board response. I'm not sure whether all of you are familiar with the latest developments in this area. So just to fill you in briefly, as you know, there has been GAC advice on IGO names, and the ICANN board has responded to the GAC during the Beijing meeting, saying that the, and I'm paraphrasing here, so you should look at the original language if you want 100% certainty, that they do see difficulties with the organization's acronyms. And they have basically responded to the GAC asking three questions. I'm not sure whether we can bring them up in the Adobe, there it is. Have you been able to go through that correspondence? Okay, so basically the GAC submission consists of three documents, the letter from the GAC chair, then criteria for protection, and a spreadsheet listing the organization's names and acronyms that shall be protected. And in response to this, the ICANN Board of Directors has asked some questions and also reverted back to the GAC and said that more work needs to be done on this because the board does seem to have difficulties operationalizing the GAC advice. I'm not sure whether, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but since you have been involved quite a bit, David, could I ask you maybe to briefly explain to the group the criteria that you have developed so that everybody's is on full speed on this?
This is David. Thomas, just to clarify that, are you referring to the criteria that the GAC previously advised the board on, to which the board is responding in this letter?
Well, I was referring now to the criteria which, on the basis of which you have created the IGO list that was provided to the ICANN board. I guess that the original criteria which were included in the GAC advice are known to the group, but I'm hesitant to believe that all participants are actually familiar with the protections as they now stand in connection with the list.
Right, I understand. This is David. So, yes, there are three criteria which the GAC have advised the ICANN board would provide the basis for the population of a list of IGO names and acronyms which the GAC has advised the board should be the subject of preventive protection against third-party registration without the relevant consent of the concerned IGO whose name or acronym is concerned. And those criteria are building on the existing standard which exists with respect to the INT domain space, and they are essentially that the names and acronyms of organisations that fall into one of the three following categories should be protected, either that they be an international organisation that's established under a treaty and which possesses international legal personality, or they need to be an IGO, and I see in fact that they're just being put up on the screen so you can read them there for yourself. The second one is that that they be organisations that have that are included on the United Nations list of observers, and or that they be a distinct organ or program of the United Nations. And the reason for those two additional categories are that there are some IGOs which are not created directly by treaty, but which are created to perform a function, which is an IGO function, and they are organs or programs, I suppose, of IGOs. And the decision was taken to limit the protection for those organisations, the funds and programs within the UN system in particular, and that has had the effect of limiting the length of the list, the resulting list, which is approximately 200 organisations, and you can see their names and acronyms set out in the list which accompanies that advice. There has, as you mentioned, Thomas, now been a response from the board in response to that advice, which was the subject of some further discussion between the GAC and the board at the meeting in Beijing, and in which the board posed some additional questions to the GAC that needed to be resolved. And that was the subject of some discussion. I think it was in the Tuesday session in the Beijing meeting between the GAC and the board, and there were essentially three issues flagged in it that remained to be resolved. The first being the issue of clarifying the process by which there would be any periodic review of this list from time to time in the event that there would be changes in relevant IGO names and acronyms. The second being to clarify the issue of the languages in which the relevant names and acronyms should be protected. And there was some discussion around that, which we can get into momentarily if it's useful. And the third key point, I think, was to ask some further questions of the GAC about how provisions for coexistence between the rights that would be held here by IGOs in their names and in their acronyms in particular would be envisaged to coexist with rights that might be held by other organisations whose names may correspond to an IGO acronym in particular, and there are some examples that the board drew to the GAC's attention for purposes of further consideration of that question, including the question of how the acronym for the International Sugar Organization, which is an IGO, for example, would be reconciled with legitimate use of that term by the International Standards Organization, for example, ISO. And there were some other examples as well that were mentioned. So there's been some discussion since then, in particular about how that question should be resolved. There's also been, just for information as well, everybody I assume would be aware of the GAC communique that came out of the Beijing meeting, which has now been publicly posted and was the subject of some pretty extensive discussion in the open forum at the end of the Beijing meeting. And in that advice, in that GAC communique, there's been some further advice from the GAC to the board. In which the GAC has, and I'm not sure if that's something that we could put up on the screen, maybe it would be helpful for everybody to see that here as well, Barry, if you've got it. But the upshot of that advice from the GAC to the board was to, I suppose, to reaffirm the performance by IGOs of an important global public mission with public funds, their particular status as creations of government under international law, and that to indicate that their names and acronyms in the GAC's view warrant special protection in an expanded DNS. The GAC, I think, in that communique also was mindful of the outstanding implementation issues that the board flagged in its letter, and I think it commits itself in response to a direct question from board member Chris Disbain to actively working, to find a workable and timely way forward. And its advice, I think its concluding advice there, was to reiterate its previous advice from Toronto to the board that pending resolution of these important implementation issues, that there be appropriate preventative initial protection for the IGO names and acronyms on the provided list to be put in place at least before any new GTLDs would launch. So I think that's pretty much where we're at now in terms of the latest developments. And if there is a copy of that advice, that communique, sorry, that's available, as mentioned, maybe it could be put up on the screen. So I think it obviously is incumbent, and it's always been incumbent, but it's particularly incumbent now, I think, on us within this working group to be, to be doing some more careful thinking about, in particular, how the issue of coexistence could and should be managed, and how a mechanism to and a means to enable that to occur in a way that meets the needs of all participants can be developed. And particularly including the organisations, I think, that the board mentioned in the examples that it's been providing to the GAC. So I look forward to those continuing discussions in this group here this afternoon and going forward.
David, that's actually much more than I'd asked for. Thank you so much for this comprehensive and circumcised overview of the latest developments. I think that's most helpful. I think it also shows that in the interaction between the GAC and the board, at least in two areas, or I should say three areas, there seem to be discussions surrounding the exact issues that we also have huge difficulties with. As you will recall, we have not been able to fully answer the language question. We are in discussions surrounding an exemption process and how that should be designed. And we have also envisaged the huge issue of acronyms, because actually in the area of acronyms, the danger is much bigger for third-party legitimate users to not be able to use certain acronyms. And the risk of conflicting rights would not be that big for identical match names of the organization. So I think that's been most helpful. For those that have not been in Beijing and could not participate remotely, during the Beijing meeting or shortly before that, we actually learned that a list of the IGO names and acronyms has been produced and provided to the ICANN board. This was too short notice for us to actually review as a group. But still, I guess the important message for us is that we that we're dealing with a list that is not as long as I guess some in this group would have anticipated, which is why we have started a discussion during the Beijing meeting whether, you know, we should sort of shortcut our discussion surrounding qualification criteria for IOC, RCRC, and the IGOs. And in brackets, I should add that this still leaves the work of working on the INGOs with us. But for the first three, we could use the criteria and the list as provided by the GAC and implement or at least consider the implementation of whatever protection mechanisms we might come up with, and we would not have to deal with the difficult question of how to determine objective qualification criteria for at least for the first three categories of organizations. We have discussed this quite extensively in Beijing, and I'll get back to that in a moment. But I guess that for the time being, for us, the important news is that the list is not too long. Both GAC and the board do appreciate the fact that an exemption process is needed, and process needs to be refined, so our work could help with this. And we've also learned that the question of acronyms is not as clear. You know, we were sort of supported in the group's diverse view on the acronyms. Now, I guess, can I ask those who are not speaking to put their mics on mute, including the mic in the Adobe, please? And I guess we now, as a group, need to take advantage of this ongoing discussion between the board and the GAC and see how our work can best fit in. So this is sort of in between agenda items number two and agenda item number three. So I'd very much like to open it up to the group and discuss how we can best proceed with this, because I guess we should also look at options to more closely interact both with the GAC and the board, but certainly we as a working group were charted with limited task, and I think it would not be appropriate for us to directly liaise with both the GAC and the board, but I'd be open to hearing from you as to what your proposals are, and then we can discuss with Jonathan Robinson, who is the GNSO Council Chair, whether he would be supportive of, establishing communication channels on the subject. So does anybody of you want to comment on that or make suggestions? Because I think that, we should not look at our piece of work in isolation, but maybe offer what we've achieved so far in terms of facts that we've collected and also options that we have considered and put this at the disposal of both the board and the GAC.
Thomas, this is Chuck.
Chuck, please go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Since I'm traveling, I can't get on Adobe Connect, so thank you. And I still have connectivity, as you can tell. It may go away any time, and if it does, possibly Liz could give information with regard to the registries. But we talked in our meeting last Tuesday for the registries in Beijing. We talked coming up with the position that we will be communicating in writing to the group, hopefully before the next meeting. We talked about this issue, and there seemed to be general support from the registries to enter into a dialogue with the GAC, whether it be the working group or the GNSO Council or some combination. I don't think it matters too much, especially if we do decide, as one of our possible recommendations, to use the list provided by the GAC. And that would give us an opportunity to, go over the list and express any concerns that we have. They could express their concerns. We could provide rationale. I don't know how the GAC would want to handle it in terms of who from the GAC would participate. That's a problem the GAC would have to work out. But we generally, as registries, think that would be a good idea. And as you'll see, when you see our recommendations with regard to working group recommendations, that would fit very nicely in what the registries are willing to support.
Thanks very much, Chuck. I have Claudia next.
Hi, Thomas. This is Claudia. I'm raising my hand for ISO. I know that we've been mentioned as one of the organizations whose short name in this particular case corresponds with an IGO acronym that is on that list. So I have a couple things to say, actually. I think, number one, from our perspective, the first thing is to say this list is a result of and the problems with having an acronym like ISO that can stand for a couple different organizations quite legitimately for decades is that we have not given thought, we have not created criteria that are going to encompass not just IGOs but other INGOs. I think that this, from the very beginning, we've been saying it's important for the criteria to include all of the international organizations that are at stake here. Well, we've gone a bit of a different way. The GAC has gone in this particular way to describe only IGOs, but and that might be a very great description for IGOs, but in any kind of recommendation for special protections, we're definitely going to need to include INGOs. INGOs that include an organization like ISO, which has over 160 member countries that represent together the largest global multi-stakeholder standards community. Those countries generate some 98% of the world gross national income. It represents 97% of the world's population. ISO has been established for over 65 years. We have published over 19,000 standards, including standards like ISO 3166, upon which CCTLDs are referenced, and other ISO standards that are referenced in the applicant guidebook. We have experts, 5,000 experts from many different industries, business, governments, regulatory agencies, consumer organizations, laboratories, academia, in over 160 different countries.
Claudia, I guess that the merits of ISO are on record already. Let me ask you a clarifying question. That is, are you now talking about contentions between IGOs that are listed and your organization, or the question of qualification criteria for INGOs, in which case I would suggest that we discuss these separately.
Thomas, I'm talking about two things. I'm talking about one, the disadvantage of having of looking at criteria for only one set of organizations, and then not the others. In which case, number two, there may be coexistence between international organizations or among international organizations. So absolutely, I'm talking about those two issues. So not just the idea of only looking at one set of international organizations and coming up criteria for them, which I think is a problem, and we can see that here. And then two, no matter what criteria we come up with, whatever that pool of international organizations will end up being, any kind of protection that we recommend they receive needs to have some very, very strong and very meaningful exemptions or safeguards or considerations for legitimate users. And we stand in the funny position of being both an organization that is seeking protection and an organization which has an acronym, a short name, that is coincides with the acronym of another international organization. So it's both. I'm trying to make an emphasis on both aspects.
Mm-hmm. Now, you will recall that... who's that?
This is Chuck again. Could I ask Claudia a question as well?
Please do.
Please do, Chuck.
Thanks. Claudia, have the INGOs or specific INGOs like yourself approached the GAC on this issue like the IGOs did and like the Red Cross and IOC did?
From what I know, Chuck, I'm not aware of at least ISO having contacted the GAC in a particular way up till now. That it might have been the case, but I'm not aware of it. I do know that there is another INGO in this working group, which is the AC, the International Electrotechnical Commission, which is another standards organization, which is a member of this group as well. That doesn't mean that we might not use that channel of communication to bring a very real world example of the necessity to make some safeguards for legitimate interests.
Thanks, Claudia, and thanks, Chuck. Before I move to Wolfgang, I'd just like to make two points, and that is, number one, in terms of qualification criteria, it is true that the group has tried to come up with a uniform set of qualification criteria for all four groups of organizations. But in the course of our work, we found out that this is not achievable, which is why we have separated the definition of qualification criteria for the four. And I think that now that the board has come up with qualification criteria for IGO and IGOs and has produced a list on the basis of these criteria, it is perfectly appropriate for this group to build on that. As regards to the second point, which is the coincidence of legitimate third-party users and IGOs, Claudia, your example illustrates quite nicely that we need very robust and fair exception processes in order not to impose disadvantages of legitimate third-party users vis-a-vis the IGOs that have the privilege of being on the list. Wolfgang, please.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. This is not directly related now to the discussion, but just two very brief comments on the GAC communique. One thing is what I discovered is that the Governmental Advisory Committee, when it refers in the point G, to the IGO questions. It refers only to the board and ICANN staff and more or less ignores the work of our working group and the GNSO Council. I think this is, I don't know whether it's just an omission, but I think we should also invite the GAC permanently to participate in this discussion from the very early beginning under the early engagement aspect. Because, you know, my impression is that the board, you know, that the GAC doesn't like, in principle, this working group and the policy development process and wants to regulate everything directly with the board and the staff. But I think we have an own interest here, and so we have discussed this, you know, and have asked some questions which didn't please neither the board nor the GAC. And in so far, you know, I would just wanted to flag that I see in the GAC communique here an omission that the GAC, when it comes to the protection of intergovernmental organization, does not refer to the GNSO, and probably we should take note of this and use the next opportunity to repeat our invitation to the GAC to join this discussion. And the second very brief point is, you know, the comparison with the 3166 list was raised already several times in this group. So the 3166 list managed by ISO has also a reserve list, and I think this is a way we could move forward. That means if we come to a list, we can work with annexes, which includes exemptions or, you know, a reserved list, you know, for names which, you know, are very close to it. So that means we should build our proposals, the final recommendations, on already existing practices and not try to invent something new, because, as I said several times in this group here, neither ICANN nor the GNSO Council or this group is in a position to define exactly what an intergovernmental organization or non-governmental organization is. I think there are other bodies around the globe which have better experiences in these types of classifications, and ISO is certainly one of them. Thank you.
Wolfgang, I have one follow-up question. You were touching upon the issue of exemption processes, or rather not just exemption processes, but actually us coming up with a list of exemptions. How are you actually proposing that we would prepare or take from third party an exhaustive list of legitimate third party users? I think that's hardly possible.
You know, life is so colorful, and even if you have a perfect list, there will be cases, you know, which create some difficulties. You know, a very simple one is the WHO, which is the acronym for the World Health Organization, and at the same time, you know, a generic word, WHO. So, and I think for such cases, probably we should have some agreement, you know, under which conditions we probably would have some exemptions which are cannot be listed on the main list and the reserve list.
Okay, so you would still suggest that we come up with a methodology or a process to...
something like that, yeah, which would give the whole system a certain kind of flexibility. So, because always if you come with a list, you know, which has a full stop, then you, exclude probably the flexibility to handle very specific cases. But we have to be very careful that such specific cases, you know, can be defined in a very narrow way. Otherwise, we have more exceptions than the exceptions dominates the rule.
Yes. Thanks, Wolfgang. Before I move to David, let me just... get back to the first point that you made, which is the GAC addressing the ICANN board and staff only to collaborate with them in terms of how to operationalize GAC advice. This is certainly an area of concern. I am not sure whether this the working group is the appropriate forum to have this discussion. Some of you will know that there has been extensive debate on the GNSO Council surrounding the question of bypassing the GNSO and the Council, and what can be done in order to prevent that from happening and thereby preserve the functionality of the GNSO as a policymaking body in ICANN. But your point is well taken, and for the group, at least for those that have not yet received that piece of information, Jonathan Robinson, the GNSO Council Chair, has been asked for a short discussion on the IGOs by the GAC Chair, Heather Dryden, and I happen to be together with Brian in that conversation, and we have in that forum also encouraged early participation by GAC members in order to make sure that they know what we're doing and why we're doing things. And in that sense, I've also made a statement in the public forum in Beijing in order to hopefully raise awareness for the PDP work that we're currently conducting. David.
Thanks, Thomas. Just a factual point in response to Wolfgang's earlier observations about the particular language in the GAC communique about working with the board and ICANN staff, which is referenced there in paragraph G. I would speculate that the possible reason for that very particular form of language may have been that the board itself, when it was asking these questions of IGOs, I think very particularly sought a commitment from the GAC to work indeed with the board and with ICANN staff, and I think they used that specific language, and it may be that that language simply made its way into the GAC's communique in response to that question as put by the board. I don't know that, but it may very well be so. Just an observation more generally also about the possibility of engaging in some work on the assembly of a list of potentially legitimate users for which exemptions could be granted in advance. I think that would be a very difficult proposition and a very ambitious one in practice. And I also agree that I think if we would go down that route, we would risk potentially excluding some potentially legitimate users. So I think that as we go forward, and I should say, I think there is recognition within the IGO community more generally that the issue of how the consent process would work so as to reassure competing claims is an important one and an issue on which important work still has yet to be done. I don't have all the answers yet about how that process would operate. But certainly I think the sentiment expressed earlier about building on existing practice where that has proved successful is useful. There are, of course, as a matter of practice, already mechanisms which exist in the trademark world in which, for example, if a trademark owner would wish to make use of an acronym that corresponds to an IGO name or acronym, they can already communicate with the IGO for that purpose, for the purpose of informing any subsequent trademark registration. So that's a mechanism, where the request is looked at, and that the consent, I think, is not something that would typically be unreasonably withheld. But certainly, I think there's recognition that there is a need for some form of consent mechanism which operates on the basis of some form of objective criteria that can give some real-world comfort to other potentially legitimate users. Obviously the long-standing use, of an identifier which corresponds exactly to a protected IGO acronym could be one highly relevant consideration in thinking about the objective criteria that an IGO itself would have to apply in determining whether or not consent would be given, and in the event that the consent would not be reasonably forthcoming or reasonably forthcoming within a reasonable period, would then give any third-party user a basis for some subsequent challenge to that, possibly by reference to a mechanism in which there'd be an impartial assessment under those objective criteria. As I say, I don't have all the answers on what they would be at this point, but I think that's certainly a fruitful direction for our discussion in this GNSO process to take, and one I look forward to hopefully continuing to participate in.
Can I read directly?
I'm sorry,
yes,
Thomas?
David, I guess that we will get back to your proposals for the exemption process, hopefully even during this call. But, Botham, you wanted to respond to that.
Yes. While I fully agree with the majority of the points you have raised, but in one specific point, we should read the GATT communique very careful, because the idea, to handle the acronyms or names of IGOs like trademarks, faced a lot of opposition in the GAC, and it's also in the GAC communique where it said that the GAC sees that IGOs are in objectively different category to other right holders. So I think the clear language, other right holders are trademark right holders here. So that means while I would agree that the mechanism which we have introduced for trademarks could be used also for IGO to a high degree, but we should not, mix this too much. In particular, should not mix it if it comes to existing mechanisms like the Trademark Clearinghouse or something like that. So I had discussions with some GAC members, and my impression was that, they have a very clear understanding to separate the mechanisms for the protection of trademarks and the protection of IGOs. So with all respect to the similarity in the procedures, but this should be handled differently.
Yang, this is David. I fully agree with those comments. I think they're exactly on point. And I think we do need to be very, very careful and very, very clear that when we are drawing on the mechanisms that currently exist for the protection of trademarks, that we be very, very clear that the substantive basis for the protection of a trademark holder and an IGO in particular are different. They are different categories, and they're different categories of rights, and they have different legal foundations. And I think we need to continue to be very mindful of that while also working together towards a solution that works functionally for all participants, hopefully, in this process.
Thanks, David and Wolfgang. Now, you really dived into the heart of the matter. Before we get back to that, let me just recap on agenda items number two and number three. I understand that the group would be favorably looking at us seeking for options to work with both the board and the GAC to help inform their discussions and also maybe come up with suggestions. Certainly, no group view will be presented prior to us actually having a group view. Should we ever get one, given the diversity of this group? But I take the signal as encouragement to reach out to Jonathan Robinson and seek opportunities to reach out to both the board and the GAC. And again, as Wolfgang said, encourage early engagement by the GAC to better understand and be part of the discussions that we have here. Now, regarding agenda item number four, which is the discussion of opportunities for compromise, I guess we need to step back for a second, and we've been discussing the IGOs quite a bit now, but let's try to put this into perspective. We are dealing with potential protections of four types of organizations, being the IOC, the RCRC, the IGOs, and the INGOs. We do have GAC advice for the first three of them, and the GAC advice regarding IGOs we've just discussed. We have not yet discussed the latest GAC advice on the IOC and the RCRC. As you will know, temporary protections are in place for the IOC and the RCRC, and the GAC has now advised the board to perpetuate these provisional protections. So, you know, for the 3 out of 4 categories of organizations, we actually do have concrete lists of strings that could form the basis for protection mechanisms without forcing us to come up with a methodology or objective criteria to define what strings should go on the list or what organizations should be entitled to be a part of the program or and which not. Because the temporary protections for IOC and RCRC do actually conclude exhaustive lists of strings. So the benefit of taking this approach, and I know that I'm repeating myself, but I take this risk gladly because it might facilitate our work to a certain extent. The benefit of that would be that we can actually shortcut our discussion of qualification criteria and just revert to the existing list for IOC and RCRC as already included in the applicant guidebook, and we could revert to the list on an as-is basis provided by the GAC to the ICANN board. Now, that is for the names. For the acronym, certainly would need to discuss more. And the proposal that I put on the table, because as you will recall, we have diverging views on almost every issue that we're discussing. So my attempt to come up with a compromise solution was to actually use these, use the list, not further discuss the qualification criteria for these three organizations, leaving us with the task of defining qualification criteria for INGOs, but actually we would need to see proposals on that from the group, which have, and you know, despite encouragement, we have not seen further proposals on that. And we could then discuss both protections for the organization's names as well as the acronyms at the top and second level. Claudia, I'll get back to you in a moment. But for the top level, one might say that there might not be the need of an exemption process. So we could just have these names reserved. And those who want to make their own application, and I guess it's up to the IGOs and INGOs in particular to let us know whether any of their peers do plan to apply for their exact match name in the second round. But in the absence of such plans, the easy solution for the top level for exact match names might be to just reserve them. And in the rare case of an organization being willing to apply for their name, we could then ask them to go through an RCEP process or to actually talk to the GAC and ask and the board and ask for an exemption. Now that is for the top level. You can think about that for a second, and I'm going to ask you for your feedback. But before I do so, I would like to give Claudia the floor.
Hi, Thomas. As you might expect, I must vigorously object to the idea of dropping the development of qualification criteria for INGOs, even if it is a little bit more difficult. INGOs like ISO are not just trademark owners. You know, when we used the word public a little while ago, over 75% of our members are governmental institutions. That means that they funnel public funds through their membership fees to ISO directly to do work for the global community. We're a very special type of INGO, and it is, I agree, difficult sometimes to define INGOs like ours. There aren't too many around. But that doesn't mean that we can drop this incredibly important work when we're talking about the reasons why such protections should be in place in the first place. And so it is difficult work that we cannot ignore. And if it does mean, again, raising my hand and saying, well, let's look at the general consultative status list of the ECOSOC, if it does meet, let's go back to some of the criteria that we had originally proposed, things like having, you know, two-thirds of your members be governmental institutions, be public institutions, whatever. We need to do it, but because we can't just simply drop this incredibly important issue. We're going to see it, and we are in the funny position, again, of having this particular acronym, but we're not going to go away in terms of asking for objective and non-discriminatory criteria, and that means for all international organizations. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia. Just one point of clarification. I have not suggested that we should drop the task of defining qualification criteria for INGOs. In fact, if you look at the transcript in a couple of days, you will see that using pre-existing lists for IGOs and using the existing protections for the IOC and the RCRC, I said would save us the burden of working on qualification criteria for these three, leaving us with the work on qualification criteria for INGOs. And so please do note that I have not abandoned that task. I've, you know, in the light of our work now being split to talk about protections for all four categories separately, using a list might make our task easier for three out of four. You will also remember that the group had huge difficulties agreeing on objective or less objective qualification criteria, which is why we have shelved that project for the time being. But you will also remember that the definition of qualification criteria that could be agreed upon by the majority of the group, or, you know, could be perceived close to consensus, have not been produced. And I've encouraged the group several times, not only for the INGOs, but also for the other three organizations, types to come up with further proposals that have not yet been discussed, which could bring us closer to a consensus position. So I repeat my encouragement to come up with suggestions, and should the group have something that we can include in a consensus call and that gets consensus, then this wish will certainly be discussed and not in any way be suppressed. Now, can I hear your views on the idea of using the designations as currently existing in the protections for IOC, RCRC, and the list for IGOs for the top level? You will remember that we have to separately discuss the top level versus the second level, and we have to discuss the exact match names and the acronyms. And my proposal, you know, not because it's my favorite option, but because I think that it might be something that, at least from what I've heard, many people could like, we could come up with a recommendation whereby the exact match names of the first three of the organizations are actually put on a reserved names list, leaving the risk with these organizations that they cannot easily apply for their own TLD, but that might be a risk that we are willing to take because of the low practical relevance and because it's relatively easy to implement. David.
Thank you, Thomas. The suggestion that I would have on that point, and I think it's a useful way forward, subject to one caveat, is that we consider proceeding on that basis, noting that the preclusion would be as against third-party registration, and that it would be possible with the agreement of the relevant IGO for an application by that IGO concerning its name to be considered. And the precedent that I would cite for that approach is the mechanism that currently exists in the registry agreement in respect of country and territory names. And that's a preclusion against registration of country and territory names other than with the agreement of the relevant government. It also provides a mechanism for the review, for a review by the GAC or the ICANN board in the event that a specific request would be made. But I think it would not need to be necessary in order to put the names on the reserve list that we not include some provision for the agreement of the relevant IGO, you know, to the registration at the top level of its name or acronym in the event that it could occur. There have been some IGOs, certainly not WIPO, but there have been some IGOs that have applied for their acronym at the top level in the current round, including CERN, and it's quite possible that there might be applications at some future time, so I don't think we need to bind that option unnecessarily here.
Understood, David Dell. The existing applications, as you rightly said, were for acronyms. You know, my proposal, or the part that I wanted to get some feedback on, was exact match names. So do you, as a representative of the IGO coalition, see a realistic case for an IGO actually applying for its full name as a TLD?
I can speak for WIPO and say that we don't have any plans to do that. I would be very surprised if there would be present plans within the IGO coalition, and I'm not aware of any, but it's possible that they may exist. So I don't see why it would be problematic to put an entry into the reserve list subject to that very limited exception for the IGO itself agreeing to any such application, you know, subject to the usual ICANN approval processes in due course for present purposes. So unless there's some reason why we couldn't include that sort of a carve-out, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't do it here.
Well, it's certainly not my intention to push for my original proposal. So let me put this out to the group. Would you be supportive of a proposal whereby for the top level for exact match for exact matches to the organization's names, we would recommend that these can't be applied for as TLDs except for by the organization in question? Can you please indicate if you don't like it? Otherwise, maybe that can be a recommendation that we can add to the list of potential recommendations in the initial report. David, is that a new hand or an old hand, Philip?
That's an old hand, sorry.
Not to worry. Okay, hearing no opposition, Claudia.
Not to oppose, Thomas. Actually, to agree. I think just for what it's worth, I would agree that the full name of the organizations that are at question, including also the to be defined INGOs perhaps on the ECOSOC list, that would be a wonderful recommendation to at least have something to have consensus on, which would be to have a reserved name list for the full name, issues of language aside.
Thanks, Claudia. Now let's move to the second level for exact match names. You will see that I've carved out the acronyms for the top level. So I hope that we can build some common ground for the exact match names and leave the difficult task of acronyms for later. So for exact match names of the organizations, I am not sure whether there is any case where an organization's exact match names needs to be held open to other third-party users. So one could consider a block, as some of you would call it, for the exact match names of the organizations. And we could say that, you know, as we did for the top level, that this recommendation would include an exemption process for the organizations themselves. And, you know, one could, because the second level is always more more difficult than the top level, one could even say that even the exact match names must be open for use by legitimate third parties. And the only case that where I think that could become really relevant, you know, judging from the past discussions, would be in the area of the IOC, with the Olympic term in particular, where I think that Olympic.diy might be a term that would be on the list, but yet need to be held open for third-party legitimate use, potentially. Can I get some views on that? Does anybody on this call oppose to that proposal? Okay, now that still leaves us with the difficult task of defining what such exemption procedure needs to look like, and we will need to talk about that more, but I'd like to give the group the opportunity to comment on acronyms. The proposal that I have put up for discussion during the Beijing meeting was that given the divergence of views in our group, and given the uncertainty or the discussions both at the GAC and the board level, a compromise could be to allow the organization's acronyms to be included in the TMCH. Now, getting back to discussions that we had earlier during this call, this is certainly not to say that organizations' names or acronyms would be equal to trademarks. We are, I guess everybody of us, is very mindful of the fact that the status of these designations is completely different. This group was just looking at existing mechanisms that could be used to facilitate the protection of certain designations, and the idea of using the TMCH as a central repository in which strings could be entered and given some special treatment for additional services to be built on that central repository looked charming, because technically, I guess it's only wise for this group to bear in mind how policy recommendations could be operationalized, and I think in that sense, our effort should be seen as the aim to use existing infrastructure, but certainly not to say that IGOs' names or acronyms actually do have the same status as trademarks would. Now, having said that, the idea of adding the acronyms to the Trademark Clearinghouse would provide benefits to the organizations because the organizations would be entitled to apply for domain names that they do want to use. Let's say WHO.health could be registered during the sunrise phase. Now, if there is no competing application, the organizations in question would be able to obtain domain registrations with priority over other users that could start registering during general availability. In case of contentions of multiple applicants during sunrise, the IGO, or you know, the benefiting organization, and the other applicant would need to be looked at. And contention sets would be resolved on the basis of the dispute resolution procedures for Sunrise that have been established by the respective registrar. Now, should an organization not apply for registration during Sunrise, then the organization would only benefit from the trademark claims service, and the domain name, the acronym, would be up for registration by whoever an eligible party could be. Now, given the fact that the organizations have sometimes claimed that the acronyms would be important for them to have, you know, these, you know, the idea or the proposal to use the existing TMCH and open it up to the organizations in question, and maybe combined with opening up UDRP and URS, would actually give them benefits to protect their acronyms, and at the same time also allow for a legitimate third-party applicant. Claudia.
Thomas, I would just like to lend my support to this proposal, to your proposal here. I think that that would be a very good way forward to allow international organizations, IGOs and INGOs, to be able to register their short name, their acronym, their name, their designation in the TMCH, and then be able to take advantage of, you know, some sort of a special Sunrise period to register their name. And I think that there's, and then if not, use the claim service as not to re-describe what you've just said, but I think it has a couple of really attractive points. I think one, it takes care of the issue of need. You know, one thing that we've been talking about is, okay, well, there's a bunch of organizations that might not even know that they're being talked about, that they might not even want to have their name as a second level or top level. So the fact that you would need to do something to take advantage of this, I think is brilliant. I think it also takes care of a big issue, which is the idea of the coexistence or the a coexistence of legitimate interests, because of course if a 100-year-old trademark owner or an IGO or whatever it is has rights, that they might be different rights, not trademark versus 6-4 or whatever it is, it'll allow them to have a separate procedure and go forth with their issues and allow other IGOs or other INGOs to go ahead and register and protect their names without having to be delayed, if you will, by the issues of coexistence and legitimate interests. So I think that this proposal that you've made is really attractive, and I think that I hope that it will be somewhere where we can have consensus, if particularly with all of the issues of reserved names list, this kind of a special protection would be really, I think, meaningful and answer some of the qualms that at least I still have.
Thanks, Claudia. I should clarify, though, that the entrance hurdle to be allowed to participate in the TMCH would, for the, you know, first three categories, be the inclusion on the list provided by the GAC. And for your organization, unless the group advises differently, I think we would still need to have some sort of qualification criteria, because otherwise we would leave out this entrance hurdle, so to speak, for the INGOs.
Sure, Thomas, just to reply really quickly, actually two things. I agree, though we actually have trademark registrations for ISO in over 150 countries, so we could fully take advantage of the trademark clearinghouse on the basis of our trademark registrations worldwide alone, even if we didn't, although we do need to have qualification criteria for other INGOs, just to throw that out there as well.
No, that's very helpful, actually, and I guess that you know, as we move along, it's good to know that that the INGOs, in particular ISO, would be in favor of using this protection mechanism. I have David, and then I guess it was you, Chuck, asking to be put in the queue?
Yes, please.
Okay, so David goes first, and then Chuck.
Thank you, Thomas. The proposal that you made about the possible use of the trademark clearinghouse is one possible way forward on the issue of IGO acronyms is an interesting one, I think. and one that we should certainly continue to think about. But I think that it's also desirable that any solution that we would come up with here to manage the coexistence issue be as simple and as cost neutral as possible. And one of the things that I think may be better calibrated to meeting both of those ends may be to think about the way that we can design a simple and hopefully cost neutral, or at least as low cost as possible, means by which the issue of any IGO consent would be required to be reasonable, and it would be required to be timely, and it would be able to be assessed by any prospective user by reference to certain objective criteria. I think this may be a mechanism that is more limited in scope and perhaps more proportionate to the problem that we're seeking to manage. So I suppose our proposal there would be to keep thinking about how this consent mechanism could operate, the timelines under which it could operate, the objective criteria on which it could work, and in particular, how we could ensure that organisations that, for example, have a long-standing use of an existing identifier that corresponds to an IGO acronym should be able to rely on that as a basis for receiving timely, simple and cost-neutral consent from the relevant IGO for that purpose. I do think that it's useful to think about the Trademark Clearinghouse, but I think there are a lot of questions there that would need to be thought through carefully in terms of the mechanics, how we would go about adjusting that procedure to accommodate the specific needs of IGO protection here, how that would work in a cost sense. I think there would be questions that we'd need to think about there that may also require consultation in due course with the Trademark Clearinghouse operator that may have views on this as well. There's a lot of contingencies here that may complicate that question. So it's why I suppose I plead a little bit for a solution that's purpose-specific and fit for purpose in a way.
Thanks, David. So just to give to keep our discussion structured, let's keep this under the heading of a consent process. I guess that is the title that you gave your suggestion. So other than using the TMCH, you would propose that we would use this consent process whereby the organization in question would consent to whatever third-party attempt for registration takes place. So that's taken good note of, and I'll now move to Chuck and then to Claudia.
Thank you, Thomas, everyone. Two things. First of all, Thomas, with regard to the idea that you described of using the Trademark Clearinghouse, et cetera, for acronyms, the registry stakeholder group discussed that last Tuesday and was supportive of that approach. Obviously, all these things have to be reviewed once the details refine, but there was good support for that idea. Secondly, I have a question for Claudia, and I'm glad she's next in the queue. If ISO has trademarks, why do they need additional protection?
Chuck? Hello?
Yes, please go ahead, Claudia.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to make sure. I think it's I thank you for your question. We do have trademarks, and so we can take advantage of the UDRP and eventually the URS. And I know it in my own skin how expensive and cumbersome that can end up being. I hate to kind of bring us back to the beginning of the whole public funds issue, but for us it's a very real one. you know, we have a budget, and we have to devote, you know, our budget to certain activities, and that doesn't leave a lot of money, to be quite frank, to chasing, you know, cyber squatting and domain name use, and it becomes more and more rampant. I see it myself when I have to check, you know, for particular domain names that have been brought to my attention as confusing or abusive by our stakeholders, and then we have to make this sort of cost-benefit analysis that every trademark owner has. Except the difference is that unlike a big private corporation, I can't really relay those costs back to the people purchasing my products. We have to make those decisions, and sometimes, you know, the abuse, we just have to let it go and hope that something along will come like this to be able to kind of help the reputation, help us protect the reputation that we've spent so many decades building. So we're a nonprofit, and we're largely funded by our members. It's really difficult, Chuck, to kind of even, to be quite frank, I'm almost overwhelmed when I think about the upcoming expansion of the DNS and having to protect our name in second levels, and then possibly in some sort of a top level dispute. When I think about our particular situation as a nonprofit organization, so that's why we're here, Chuck. Is I think because you know we do have a reputation that we would like to protect. It's very difficult if we're not the sort of private corporation that can do that and relay the cost back. So that's why we're standing here. And we have asked for you know protections, including things like fee reductions for you know nonprofit INGOs and IGOs, things like you know claims notice, if that can get us you know a little bit of consensus, because it's a real issue for us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Claudia. Thanks, Chuck. Now, I guess we should use the remainder of our time to actually discuss the issue of exemption processes versus the consent process. Now, I guess what might be closest to consensus from the various options that we have on the table might be the idea of opening up the TMCH to designations that, particularly the acronyms, as Chuck has just described. I'd very much like to get some views on the idea of a consent process as outlined by David, whereby an organization or an applicant or registrant, wannabe registrant, whatever we might call that, tries to register a domain name and needs to seek consent from the organization in question. Now, from what I have understood our discussions ending up with in the past, there was some hesitation with respect to the notion that you need to go to an organization holding a certain designation and ask that organization for consent. You will remember that Avery has called this opening the floodgates to licensing schemes. We have been reassured by the organizations in question that they have never asked for money or other favors when they have been approached by legitimate third-party users, for example, when it came to trademark registrations, which is maybe a comparable mechanism that the organizations want to copy for this purpose. So with the understanding that there is no possibility of financially exploiting granting consent to legitimate third-party users, and bearing in mind that the organizations have explained, and the latest opportunity to hear that was in Beijing, where David and his colleague Alexandra have confirmed that they have proposed a consent-based approach because it might be the easiest and most cost-effective solution, opposite to tasking an independent third party with determining whether a registrant is a legitimate registrant or not. So bearing that in mind, would you be willing to subscribe to something based on consent? To put it in a nutshell, you try to register a domain name. The domain name is actually identical to the acronym of an the IGO or an IOC. IOC has not asked for acronyms. Sorry, or the RCRC acronym, and you would then approach the organization for consent. We would still need to discuss how that consent is granted or how silence of the organization in question is construed. But let's just talk about the general notion of approaching the organization in question for consent, if this is actually a fast and cost-effective mechanism, and one could even attach an appeal process to that. I see Claudia is objecting to that, but I'm sure that others in this group also do have views on this. So am I correct in understanding? Claudia, I'll get back to you in a second. I saw in the chat that you want to speak. Am I correct in understanding that all of you, except for Claudia, would be as happy or as unhappy with an exemption procedure that is consent-based versus determined by an independent third party? So while you think about that, I give the opportunity to Claudia to elaborate on her objection.
Hi, Thomas. I think the issue of consent on a per registration basis is extremely problematic. Like I said, we are in the funny position of asking for protection and also having a name that corresponds to an acronym. So I've been thinking about this from all sides of the question, quite frankly. And I think that just speaking from the perspective of let's say a legitimate interest holder that would have a name that corresponds to an acronym, perhaps it will be mine on that list as well. I think that the idea of applying for consent on every single registration is incredibly impractical. Having to ask a particular NGO or IGO, excuse me, for permission to register a particular top level domain, like for example for us .ngo or .ong, is cumbersome. Even though I may fully trust in organizations like WIPO and other IGOs to garner consent when it's reasonable. I think it's from a commercial perspective, international organizations and other legitimate interest holders do have the right to use their names in other contexts and it's difficult to be fettered in a commercial sense to ask permission on every single level. So what might be a solution? There might be a solution in which there could be the idea of consent. Consent that is applied for or agreed to from the very beginning or from the rollout and would mean that, for example, using the ISO as the example, that any time, so if ISO was to be reserved, then it might be on a first-come, first-served basis. If we had, an agreement with the International Sugar Organization that either one of us, whoever comes first, for example, to register the second-level match, might be able to get it. They might not be interested in having a dot standard or a dot NGO because it doesn't relate to their work. So that might be a solution that I'm sort of offering here on the fly of a compromise on the issue of consent, but then also being very cognizant of business issues and practicalities. I can't imagine how many of these requests would be even sent or received. As a rights holder myself, I do get quite a few requests to use our trademarks and to use our name. And so I know even just from that perspective that it can take some time to approve and to do the analysis. So I think perhaps where there is a coexistence of legitimate interest, maybe there can be some sort of a consent that's sort of just, dialed up into the system such that, it goes down to the regular first-come, first-served basis, perhaps.
Thank you, Claudia. I'd like to hear some more views on that. Because, Claudia, the idea of first come, first serve would not work for a consent-based approach. My understanding of the consent-based approach would be that there is a default setting, which is a block for registrations, and only if the organization in question consents to the registration of a certain domain name, then it could be used. So the organization in question would not even apply for the domain name because it has the block on its site. And only if consent is unreasonably withheld, in that instance, the legitimate third-party user or the party claiming to be a legitimate third-party user that is not granted consent could then go to court or use whatever appeal process we might come up with. So we would logically never run into a scenario where first come, first serve could be an option.
Thomas, to clarify, when I said first come, first serve, I meant between the agreeing organizations. So, for example, if the two ISOs were to agree that either one of them can register the domain name, that would be on a first come first serve basis. In other words, that the IGO or any other depending on how we come up with this agreement, the international organization, the IGO or the INGO, can provide a sort of unconditional consent to another legitimate interest user, like for example the insurance company in the US that has the term ISO as well, and then either of those groups in this particular agreement would be able to then go ahead. So that precludes the problem of each single time, having to ask for several hundred, permissions to register, a name that you've had a write in for well over half a century.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. I mean, that's certainly a scenario that we would need to think about further, i.e. the clash of two legitimate beneficiaries of the program. So I was rather thinking of a conflict between third-party user, legitimate users and the organizations in question themselves. David, please.
Thanks, Thomas, and thanks very much, Claudia, as well. I think there's real understanding, from an IGO perspective of the need to think about ways to manage these questions of coexistence in ways that are simple, that are cost-effective and reduce the burden as much as possible on potentially legitimate users such as ISO, because nobody wants to be in the position that Claudia just described of having to send off potentially tens or hundreds of applications for consent to individual registrations of domains. And it may be that we need to think about ways to be even more efficient about the process. So there might be scope, for example, for building in, a one-off consent in certain relevant cases. So, for example, if ISO would approach the, or perhaps the IGO coalition could even approach the International Sugar Organization to see about the possibility for an open-ended exemption or consent, which would enable ISO to have the comfort of knowing that it would have that necessary agreement in place for any subsequent registration or use that it would need to make, and that might be something that we could think about putting into objective criteria for other organisations as well that would meet those criteria.
Thanks, David. That's very helpful. Chuck, are you still on the line?
Yes,
Thomas. I am still on the line.
I have one question for you. You mentioned earlier that the registries have discussed last week that they would be supportive of the notion of opening up the TMCH to acronyms. Have exemption processes been part of the registry's discussions as well? In other words, what we're discussing right now goes a little bit beyond the use of the TMCH and as-is basis. So do you think that this that the idea of having an exemption process or a consent-based approach would get traction with the registries, or is your impression that the opening up of the TMCH is as far as the registries could go? Because I think we all remember that the registries in particular, they have been very hesitant to support blocks or preventative mechanisms.
Yeah, well, it's hard for me to say what the rest of the registries would think specifically about what you're asking. It would be easy enough to explore, but we didn't get that specific in terms of the use of the trademark clearinghouse for the with regard to an exemption procedure. The registries are supportive of an exemption procedure, though.
Okay, but if the registries support opening up the TMCH for acronyms, it is my understanding that we would not even need an exemption procedure for that, because there wouldn't be any room for it. The exemption procedure would be needed maybe for exact match name protection at the top and second level, but not for the TMCH. That is your, or is my understanding correctly? Correct.
I think that's correct, yes.
And you will still need to discuss whether or what type of exemption procedure the registries would like. What all we know at the moment from the registries is that an exemption process would be needed, right?
Yes, I have sent the process that has been outlined so far to the registries, but haven't received any feedback on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very helpful. I'm just trying to understand what level of support we might have for particular design of an exemption or consent process. I see Mary writing in the chat that she needs to confirm with NCUC and NCSG, but that she thinks that the two groups will not support blocks or large-scale exceptions. More likely, a TMCH mechanism could find some support. Mary, it's my understanding,
Thomas,
that you're...
Thomas,
yes?
Yeah, could I, before I put myself back on mute, I can tell you that I have communicated on the registry's list that I'm supportive of a process whereby keeping the exemption process very simple, and that is if an organization that's not an NGO or an INGO had a trademark name in the trademark clearinghouse, then they would be allowed to have an exemption for that, as long as they agreed to not in any way using the name to cause confusion with the IGO or other organization that had some protection.
I guess
so
that's very...
There wouldn't be any consent process needed, because they have demonstrated in the trademark clearinghouse that they have rights to the name, even if it conflicts with an IGO or other name that is protected. Does that make sense?
That makes sense for the initial phase. So are you suggesting that the entries in the trademark clearinghouse and the that basically we make the sunrise rules permanent for these designations. I guess that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's really two things that I'm saying. One of them is that the IGO acronym could be in the trademark clearinghouse, giving them the rights to Sunrise if they wanted it, and URF. But URF maybe is a little more complicated. But I'm also suggesting that the exemption procedure would be kind of an automatic one if a non-governmental organization, excuse me, I better say a commercial organization or a non-commercial organization that's not on one of the protected lists wanted an exception, as long as they could prove that they have rights to the name via the trademark clearinghouse, that's all they would need, except for maybe a statement that they wouldn't in any way the name to cause confusion.
But, Chuck, that would actually require the TMCH to be deployed on a permanent basis.
I'm sorry, to what?
That would actually require the TMCH to be deployed or to be used on a permanent basis, because otherwise you wouldn't find out after 90 days whether a certain name is in the trademark clearinghouse or not.
I think the implication is that that would be the case anyway, because that hasn't been finalized, okay? And the reason I say that is because there are some registry applicants that have said they would like to offer the rights protection mechanisms indefinitely, like, for example, the claims notice. So the only way that could happen is if the trademark clearinghouse operated indefinitely. And if I understand correctly, ICANN staff has negotiated, I think, a 5-year agreement with the providers. And the question was asked last week in Beijing whether or not what would happen after 5 years. That was in the trademark clearinghouse section. So I think there's fairly good indication that the trademark clearinghouse would operate much longer than just enough for 90 days.
Okay, so that would be for commercial use, i.e. for those who have trademarks. I guess your point is well taken. Next is David, please.
Thanks very much. I didn't actually have my hand up. I just popped my comment into the chat bar, so I won't labour it unnecessarily. But just to note, I do agree very much that the idea of exploring the trademark clearinghouse further as a possible option is a very interesting one. But I think there would be some aspects of the proposal that IGOs would be looking at in particular, which reflects the particular status of the rights in the acronyms that would be protected. One would certainly go, I think, to the issue of duration, which has been discussed and which is currently limited under the TMC. Another is the question of cost, and I think it would be useful to see to explore a bit further how that would work. Would there be a cost? Would there be no cost? At what level would the cost be applied, if there would be cost? And I think that we would be looking for some form of exemption process, not to exclude all potentially legitimate registrations, and indeed to allow legitimate registrations where these would be identified, but to preclude certain third-party registrations where there would be an absence of legitimate use. So, for example, I couldn't imagine a problem with ISO, seeking to register a domain name containing its short form name. But if it would be, John Zuccherini seeking to register that term, or some other known cyber squatter, it might be an issue there that would need to be managed a bit more closely.
Okay, thanks, David. By the way, your hand was up. So maybe that's an old hand again.
The old hand, the vestigial hand, exactly.
So I guess we have some interesting suggestions on the table. And that would be, you know, enshrining the exemption process in a perpetuated use of the TMCH and per se granting exceptions to those who do have a trademark, which is entered into the trademark clearinghouse, which would still leave us with the issue of non-commercial third-party use. And I think that that is the case which is even more needed, if I understand correctly, the wording of 6TER of the Paris Convention, which prohibits third-party commercial use. And my question to you as a group is whether you have any suggestions as to how we can build safeguards for legitimate third-party non-commercial users into the system, i.e. those users that do not have trademarks. So, no idea on that for the moment, but I suggest that we maybe try to further build on this this proposal or this amalgamation of proposals to see whether we can come up with something addressing all the variations of commercial use and non-commercial use in it. I guess we will, or I hope that we will. Who's that?
That's Chuck again.
Chuck, please.
Is there really a need to address it beyond those who would have some demonstrated rights? It's not clear to me that it is. Now, I may be wrong, and I can accept that, but is there really a need to broaden the exception procedure beyond those that have demonstrated rights?
Well, I guess that the issue is that if at all, if there is protection for the acronyms, then it would be protection against commercial use. And I guess that non-commercial users, in most cases, would not have trademarks.
Well, I just Chuck again. I'm not sure I follow you because the trademark. I don't think the registries are suggesting that the trademark clearinghouse should be used for acronyms to protect the acronyms against commercial use. So I guess I would challenge that assumption. The idea is to give them some of the same protections that trademark holders have. And then it could also, the trademark clearinghouse could also be used for the exception procedure where that applies, so that the if a commercial organization or not-for-profit organization of some sort had the same acronym as an IGO name, for example, then because they can demonstrate rights to the trademark, they would be allowed an exception, provided that there's some commitment to not cause confusion. So I think I'm looking at it maybe a little bit differently than you are. I may be missing something.
Well, that's something we should find out, and I hope that we will continue our conversation on the mailing list then. David asked the question whether it's realistic to get changes to the TMCH in time. If the question is directed at me, I'm not able to answer it. But nonetheless, I guess we need to work as quickly as we can. And you know, the quicker we are, the better the chances are for us to have something ready for this first round, which leads us to the next agenda item, which is the status of the initial report and the review of the work plan. And I don't intentionally want to confuse Barry, but since we've talked about the, yeah, that's great. Now, you have put up the work plan, and since you've updated it, would you be kind enough to maybe guide us through it? Because I think that will partially answer David's question.
Hi, Thomas. This is Barry. So for those that are still logged into the AC room, I have the latest work plan and timeline posted up. I don't think I sent this out to the list yet, but I'll send it out after the call. Basically, we're kind of in a, as everybody is aware, in a compressed schedule. Certainly one of our main deliverables is to have an initial report that we can post out for public comment. And per PDP guidelines and bylaws, there are minimum public comment periods that we have to execute against in terms of releasing the initial report so that it can be reviewed by the council, et cetera. So one of the elements that we're working on the next version of the initial report now, certainly that won't be ready to go until the working group has formulated all of the recommendations, which is probably the most critical part of the report. In the meantime, on this next version, we're working through updating previous submissions by the stakeholders into this working group, as well as ensuring that we comprehensively cover all of the previous efforts that have been performed with regard to the protections issue. So we'll most likely have a next version out to the list to review prior to next meeting. And again, of course, it won't contain the overall recommendations, a lot of which we discussed today. I think the most important takeaway, just lost connectivity, the most important thing to recognize with respect to the timeline is that if we were to formulate the recommendations, get them published into the initial report by May 3rd, that essentially gives us until the 24th of May before the public comment period closes and that the reply period begins, at which time the working group can come together and we're bound by the PDP guidelines to review through the public comments through each one and understand if there's a material need for a change to the initial report in terms of trying to produce our final report and final recommendations. So if we were to meet each one of these particular milestones by the date that's listed before you, we would basically be at the middle of June at minimum to deliver a final report back to the GNSO Council for their consideration and potential adoption, and then thus working through the ICANN board and the GAC as well. So I think in general, I think the working group will want to try to complete its work prior to the Durban meeting, which of course is in mid-July. And this schedule kind of gives us a little bit of buffer prior to that, but I believe it'd be important for the working group to try to deliver the final report by mid-June.
Thanks very much, Barry. I mean, that's certainly ambitious given the amount of work that we still have before us, but I guess that we should try to make these dates. That leads me to my request to you to actually go through the report and create a markup or send us very concrete suggestions for changes in the report so that you can actually live with it and even better like it. We will certainly, you know, if we're on track with the schedule, we will certainly approach the GNSO Council leadership and maybe ask them to hold a special meeting so that we can get GNSO Council approval as soon as possible. And we would certainly, you know, depending on how things go, do the same vis-a-vis the board to encourage the board to look at our recommendations as soon as they can, as possible. With this, I think we can almost close the meeting. It's just, another The last point that... Who's that? Okay, I thought there was somebody wanting to talk. The next meeting is going to be on the 24th, and that is at 16 hours UTC for 120 minutes. Unless anybody of you have more questions, I'd like to bring this meeting to a close. It's 4 minutes to the hour, so we're good on time. Thanks to all of you for your participation and your good suggestions, and I hope that we can get some traction with the new proposals that we now have on the table. Thank you so much, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.